Take two of this is not a history. Wait.
Oh, man, we're off to a good start. I literally just pressed play and then accidentally hit the stop button. So if that tells you.
Yeah, we're getting it together.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be okay.
Cal's had a long day at work. I have not had a long day at work because Kat's not currently working.
Unemployment.
And it's beautiful.
You know what? Take it when you can. There's
I got that nice
about,
little gap. I think it's knowing that there is something.
That there is a job.
I have security. Like, yeah. There's something coming. I just, yeah. It's just a matter of,
you
like,
just, it's a waiting
gotta
game.
Wait for it. Yeah. So, like, it's beautiful. I'm feeling, like, so relaxed. I have not been this. I've done yoga the last couple days. I've like stretched. I did a little like room workout. I like moved my bed. I finished writing a novel. I've been decorating. I repotted my plants over the weekend. I'm sewing little like hand embroidery, starting project. I finished a sewing project. I'm like, is this what it is like?
I know.
To have freedom?
Without the ravages of capitalism?
It's been so beautiful. I've read like 3 books.
Yeah.
In the last like few days. And then like one of them was 800 pages. I finished it at 4:07 a.m. this morning. It was 800 pages and so worth it. But yeah, awesome. I've been feeling the effects of freedom capitalism.
Hell yeah.
Well,
take
actually,
it while you can.
Technically it's not because we can never truly be free of capitalistic influence. But like, I am the most free of capitalism right now that I will ever be in the rest of my life.
That is very true. And so I say take it while you can.
I'm taking the win. Taking the win.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Kat's having a great time.
I am
working.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I'm over here bragging while Cal came home and she was like,
It wasn't a bad day. It just was one of those days that just dragged on.
Yeah.
It was just so like, I like literally at like probably 11, I was like, oh, it's like 4:30.
Oh no.
And then I was like, oh, it's not.
You're like waiting for your lunch break. And then you're like, oh no, this is only lunch.
I know. So, you know,
the weather doesn't help. This is the total curl up with a book rainy day kind of weather. And it's like the fact that you can't is what makes it worse.
It kills you. And that's like, I would love to have a window in the office that I'm working in right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in any office, but almost on days like this, it's almost better to not have one.
So you can don't just know be, what
yeah, like plausible deniability. You can just be like, oh, it's not happening.
Oops.
There's not a really pretty day outside.
I don't know what's going on.
I'm not stuck inside in this cave. So, you know, but honestly, it was a good day other than that.
Good.
So we are having a new exhibit come in at the end of April. And we got the shirts today, so that's
ooh,
a whole lot of fun.
That is very fun.
Yeah, I looked on the price tag. They're selling those babies for $30 a pop in our museum stores.
Sounds
so
about right, honestly.
I'm like, I'll take it free. Thank you. Especially because they don't have any branding from our museum on it.
So you can wear it forever.
Yeah, so it's just like a shirt, which is kind of funny because I'm almost like, I wish I had branding because that would be cool. It's like exclusive.
Like this,
you know?
Is the museum I worked
like a
at
staff
when we
shirt.
Had.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was fun. We also had a chili cook-off, which was interesting.
Oh, I missed it this year. No.
Have you been before?
Yeah. When we were grad assistants.
Yeah. I never went because I was like, I'm not going to that.
Oh. I loved it. It was fun.
I will say the chilies were not how I would make chili.
No, none of them were. And I think it's because a lot of the employees are not Southern. Well, a lot of the employees who participated in the year I did were not like Southern.
Okay, what is a good chili to you? Does it have
beans in it? There's that whole debate. I'm fine with beans or not beans. I know that's a huge conversation in Texas about if there's beans in your chili or not. My thing is whether or not you've got some tomato in the base.
Mm.
The best chilies have tomato in the base.
That's true. To me, it's tomato and beans. Like, you gotta have...
See, otherwise, it's just meat and that's a stew.
It's just meat.
I like beans in it.
And that was the thing. One of them was like, the flavor was good, but it was just like, it was literally stew meat in it.
Yeah.
And you could taste that it was stew meat.
I don't like chili. I'm used to chili with ground meat. I'm okay with if it's not.
Beef,
but like, ground beef is... Otherwise, it's a stew.
Yeah.
And that's why I love, like, I've had green chilies before that I liked, but, like, at the end of the day, chili's got to be a tomato-based thing for me if it's going to be good. So I have, like, a lot of opinions on chili.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's sad. I missed it by a couple weeks this year.
Yeah,
dang.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, It was fun, but it also was kind of like, chilly at work.
See, I love that kind of work shenanigans, personally. I'm here for that.
I honestly, it's probably because I'm a huge bitch, but all of the forced staff, let's hang out kind of stuff, I cannot stand.
I love that stuff.
I hate it. I don't like it. It's not that I don't like talking to my coworkers, but there's something about it being, like, forced that just makes it like painful.
See, the painful part for me is the when it's the bosses, like, who are like, hey, thanks for your hard work, here's a pizza party. That is like so gratuitous. Those are the work functions, yeah, I hate, because it's like, stop trying to sympathize with us, empathize with us, make us feel anything,
yeah,
for you.
Yeah,
you are the boss.
Yeah, that does suck. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm like,
hey, not everyone
at my core, like a little like punk kid, like, I don't like being forced to do things.
Well, and work too, like, you, it's different.
Yeah, and it's like, I get that, like, you know,
some people like it, some people don't. That's totally fine.
Well, and I get too that, like, genuinely work is a better experience when you are actually friendly with the people that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like certain things that I'm like, and especially because, like, the museum that I work at and you're going to work at, it's like there's like three people that are our age.
Yeah.
And so I
I know how, I know,
you know,
what you mean.
And I'm like, what am I gonna do? Like, we had our staff retreat and at the main event here this year,
mm-hmm,
and that was just a bizarre experience because, like, they gave us time to, like, go and play the games, and I, like, didn't have anyone to talk to because, especially at that point, I didn't have anyone to really, mm-hmm, hang out with at that point. And then, like, we bowled. It was just,
yeah, that is weird. See,
yeah,
I think I spent a lot of time in my previous jobs with very different demographics, notably much older people than me, and I think it has provided me a certain sense of comfort with the varied age ranges that not everyone has up to this point in their work experience. Because for me, like, that, like, the, like, I get along with old people older than me.
Well, it's not that I don't get along with them, it's just that, like, at a certain point I don't have anything to talk to, like, with them.
Okay.
You know, and it's like,
maybe I can attribute that to the fact that I could talk to a brick wall.
Yeah, you were definitely, you definitely talk to people more than me.
I'm a chatty Cathy. Chatty cat.
Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, I can see why it wouldn't be the most fun cook-off experience, but I'm glad that you went.
I mean, I enjoyed it. It ended up being fine. It just is like, I just,
it's not your thing. It's totally
yeah, it's not my thing.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know what
anyway,
is your thing?
What is my thing? History?
History.
I was going to say, now that we've talked for like 20 minutes about,
oh, did we really?
No.
Okay, I was about to say, damn.
It was like 5 minutes.
When it's chilly, about, I guess it really goes off.
About, like, the horrors of the modern workplace.
Yeah. We're going to bring you some history now.
Yeah.
Quick little
switch. And it is episode 115.
Never thought we'd get here. That's a lot, actually, when you really think about it. That means,
yeah,
we've covered 230 topics in total.
Yep, and I'm gonna choose not to think about it because that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's like when you look up at space or the deep sea.
Oh, I love,
I know we
space.
Have different concepts of,
yes,
space and sea, but
and actually sea doesn't freak me out like deep sea.
Oh, okay. See, it
I
doesn't
know
really
people
freak
like
me out either.
I know people get like grossed out by that.
Yeah,
like have like a physical reaction, but
yeah, it doesn't bother me.
I mean, what I love just being like above a void. Probably not, just like there, but it wouldn't
terrify, yeah, me. Yeah, well, seeing that it is 115, that means we are themed today.
We are themed, and if you listened to last episode, we mentioned that, hey, you know, the Ottoman Empire
that spans like 600 years,
not 600,
that's a very underestimated number.
Like, we're pushing 1,000 with the Ottomans.
I was thinking, it's kind of like how that guy, what's that meme? He's like, how long did the Greek Empire last? And he's like, 2 years. And they were like, you're not wrong, but you are not correct.
Oh my gosh. I have to stop talking, but Philomena Kunk, the history document, mm-hmm, like the mockumentary.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
She is so funny.
I love her. Yes. If
yeah,
you,
it's on Netflix.
Save it for your recommendations.
Yeah, well, I have another recommendation, but
okay,
that just reminded me.
Well, that
of
can
that.
Be my rec then.
Yeah, yeah,
that'll be my because I, yeah, do love her stuff.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so after last episode, I was like, "Hey, we have a theme," and Maybe we should use it to, like, actually force ourselves to talk about the Ottoman Empire. Not that we don't want to. It's just, like, for whatever reason.
Somehow it has just not hit our radar.
Yeah, yeah. So we are doing that today. So we are bringing you two topics from the Ottoman Empire. And I know what Kat's doing, and it's going to be a little bit funny because I'm doing really early on in the Ottoman Empire, and yes. You're literally doing the end of it.
Yes.
So we're doing backwards order.
Yes.
So you'll get the end of the book before the beginning here, but that's okay.
Epilogue before the prologue.
Yep. A little bit of spoilers for the Ottoman Empire.
If you didn't know, the Ottoman Empire no longer exists. So this is how that happened. Indeed, yes. I will be starting today with the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Lay it on me.
Okay. Do you watch the Frosty the Snowman, the animated one, the really old one, growing up?
I watched it like a few times, but it was never like on my watch list.
The guy in the top hat, when he goes, messy, messy, messy. You know that dude?
No.
Okay, well, maybe that's just a very, very strong singular memory for me.
The animated one, right?
Mm-hmm. The very old animated one.
Then no. I was thinking of the claymation ones.
Oh, nope. That is not it. I'm talking about like the OG, like original.
No, I've never seen that. Then, yeah.
Yeah. See, we quote that a lot around my house. Missy, missy, missy. And that's the best way I can describe the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Let's hear it. Honestly, the stuff I'm doing today is like drama too. So okay. They just seem like they might be a little bit messy through and through.
Alrighty. Well, anything this big has too many political players and parts to not be spectacularly messy.
Very valid.
So, summary, in case you want to skip mine and go straight to Cal's, I will try not to be offended. Fall of the Ottoman Empire, despite a very notable effort to try and modernize and fit in with a changing world, this massive, long empire, one of the longest lasting, faced a very slow and long decline, unlike many other civilizations that were either like taken over or essentially conquered or fell from internal strife. Yes, there was like a kind of almost conquering-ish end to the Ottoman Empire, but it had been in decay and descent for quite a while. Which causes a very complex discussion about why the Ottoman Empire fell and how and what could have prevented it among historians. Because most historians do not agree on exactly what the most powerful factor was.
Okay.
And I will note that I had to do a couple bias checks on myself throughout this research, just because the Ottoman Empire is huge.
Yeah.
It is massive.
Huge.
So you're talking about a lot of different places involved. Because I did some, like, back reading just to give myself a context again of, like, the general progress of the Ottoman Empire. I didn't go anything too far back in my research in depth, but I read over it. And it's just so much from such a wide spread of history.
Yeah.
That I realized I was projecting a lot of my modern biases onto it. At one point, I was reading something about Muslims in Russia. Mm. And my brain was like, oh, my brain like stuttered for a second. Was like, huh? And I had to reread the sentence because I was like, it's not something in my current context that I think about. But it's good to check that, especially when you're talking about something as complex and geographically diverse as the Ottoman Empire.
Well, it's all of those things you mentioned. And then the time period it existed in. So much happened in world history.
Yes.
And there was such radical change from when it started and then to when it fell. I mean, like the entire
world
Renaissance, Reformation, Enlightenment. Like we came into the modern era.
Yeah. Industrial Revolution had happened.
Yeah.
Like we went from Renaissance to Industrial Revolution in this span.
Not even Renaissance.
Yeah.
Middle Ages.
Like,
yeah. So it's impressive just the longevity of it.
It really is.
Yeah.
Few things can we talk about how long things survive sometimes on the show, but like how much they survive is almost more impressive than how long. Because anything can survive for a while in a vacuum.
Right.
When the world is not changing so much, when you're not facing outlying factors and threats. But the Ottoman Empire saw drastic changes.
Yeah.
It very well could have fallen through many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, wow. It's like truly is to see like such a big thing fall at the time. And a lot of that's part of the discussion too I saw is historians saying like nothing but a world war could have been the final death note. Yeah. But a lot of historians are like, no, it was in decay and it could never have caught up.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting to kind of hedge these different arguments. So
yeah, that's interesting too, because that same kind of debate will come into play with my topic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So. Awesome. Well, I'm going to briefly mention the earlier declines, because we start seeing a decline in the late 1500s, like a marked decline. After Suleiman?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what I saw when I did a quick little timeline, too, because I was like, I did the same thing. I was like, I need to contextualize myself before I try to do this topic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so they, I mean, essentially what happened is from everything I'm reading, if I could put it into words, the Ottoman Empire got a little too big for their britches.
As empires tend to do.
They had taken Belgrade. They had broken power in Hungary. They were riding the high of attacking Persia 3 times. They had expanded their naval power. They controlled a huge space. At its max, they had holdings in Asia, not just Asia Minor, but like Southeastern Europe, North Africa, Middle East. Like, and if you look at maps of the height of the empire, it's very geographically dispersed. It is not centralized. Uh-huh. And that is debatably a pro and a con.
You just get into like logistical issues when you have an empire that big.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially when, I mean, seafaring and trade routes and everything are vitally important, because the empire is separated at its height by such a massive water. But having empire on both sides of it also give you control of that water.
Yeah.
So like it's again a pro and a con. There's so many factors. It's just it's kind of hard to comprehend. And they didn't have just a lot of land. They had up to this point into the 1500s been a huge mark of advancement and architecture and art and some really incredible stuff that was being done, even with technology and learning and everything. But again, they did kind of spread themselves too thin and they weren't as effective as they needed to be about centralizing some of their power and forces and resources. Mm-hmm. So we really start to see themselves, like our first blow to the Ottoman Empire that marks the, oh, they didn't accomplish this. They didn't accomplish what they set out for, is when they try to send troops in an attempt to take Vienna. The first time they did that was 1529. And that first time he did it, he was running low on supplies and everything. He had the whole empire had to kind of like retreat and be like, okay, we've overstepped here. But Austria is not a weak power at this point.
Yeah.
And the Ottoman Empire being so spread out and their forces being so spread out, they try a couple times. And they finally try one last time in 1683. That's a pretty big jump. That's over 100 years jump forward. So they've been like pushing for Austria in this space for a while, but they overextended themselves. And that loss of...
That's a hit.
Of Vienna. Well, not loss, but that loss of the battle and the attempt to conquer the capital of Austria.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah, for sure.
The finances of the war, of that attempted conquest, and were massive. I mean, any war, any conquest is a drain on an empire. But in general, they were also just a really opulent
court. That's for this... For, like, an introduction to the Ottomans, I didn't want to focus on, like, that kind of stuff, but their, like, cultural and social history is so, like, rich, and, like, there is some juicy aesthetics from the Ottoman Empire. Oh, gosh,
it's
like,
beautiful.
Oh, my God.
It's beautiful, and it's also, it's kind of, like, now we project, again, our own bias, because, like, what did they have wealth of in resources?
Right.
It's things that now we consider to be valuable.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was... Like, this is what our kingdom has. This is what our empire has. Yeah. So, like... But it's so beautiful. And it's so rich. And that's why... Oh, God. I just wish I could visit any place.
I know.
You know, talk about, like, visiting places in history. Gosh, I just wish I could have seen the Ottoman Empire. But...
The closest we would get is... What's that city in North Africa? What is it?
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah. That's, like, kind of still that last... Morocco. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I would love to go.
I know
Morocco.
People talk about that as
Morocco, like at the peak of the Ottoman Empire, though.
Don't talk to me about it. I'm going to cry.
My God.
So yeah, that in like cultural practices, the court giving itself a like. I don't. It's not officially a court because they didn't have like a king in that context, but what they were spending on government officials and the war, they're losing financial strength. And they were losing their organizational skills as well. The government had been kind of stacked and filled and kind of manipulated in a lot of ways to put favor with certain people, mm-hmm. which, I mean, is not uncommon in history, but it had been done so much that it was not on a solid base mm-hmm. anymore. Yeah. There was a lot of intrigue and people playing for their own interests instead of the people.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it's just really corrupt and struggling to stand on its own two legs. After this failure of an attempt to take Vienna, they also lose their, well, they relinquish their hold on Hungary in 1699 because of the reach and what it was taking to hold it and everything.
So this is the first time they're having to give up.
We're starting to see not just, oh, we lost, but, oh, we are actively letting go.
Gotcha.
And through the 1600s and 1700s, there's a definite decline in power because they're also focused on the Russo-Turkish Wars, as well as continued conflict with Austria and Poland. Again, they're just spreading themselves a little too thin,
mm-hmm.
and it's really hard. Again, they might have sea transport, but it is not the equivalent of picking up a cell phone and being like, hey, send your forces, we need backup. It's never that easy.
Yeah.
Another factor that we also have to be paying attention to, it's much more mundane and less dramatic than, you know, we're going to war. It's agriculture.
Hmm.
The Industrial Revolution is hitting Europe late 1700s, early 1800s. Europe is right next door to them. The Ottoman Empire doesn't immediately jump on this trend. They keep a lot of their agrarian practices. And yes, everyone needs food still, which theoretically, Ottoman Empire should still be fine. Like, if they're supplying all that food and everything, it should still be, they should hold their own. They'll still be of value to Europe. Problem is, they didn't build out their factories and mills and stuff to take the product they're producing and refine it. And so they fall behind a bit. It's not even so much that they weren't producing metal and steel yet. That isn't the hindrance. It's the fact that they can't even refine their own materials to the standard that is required by the rest of the world who has gone through the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. You have to stay relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're really not. Mm-hmm. So what they are producing, although necessary for the rest of the world, and everyone needs, I mean, they need their food. Everyone else is going to benefit from it. But their economy is not where it needs to. There's a word for this. It's not opportunity cost. What is the word? What you make on top of what you need.
Your surplus?
Surplus. Thank you. Yes. All the financial surplus that they have, mm-hmm. it doesn't go to them. Because of their previous financial situations and agreements and deals, all of their surplus is going to European countries to pay off credit.
Mm.
And they're used to that lifestyle of opulence, and all of a sudden
they can't
do that.
Yeah.
The rest of the world has also been dealing with a lot of interconnected globalization and trade at this point, not just industrialization. Mm-hmm. They might have arguably been okay without industrializing and just producing raw materials, but they're competing with America and the Indias for trade.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're a little bit more, not landlocked, but they're not up against the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
With easy access. They have a little bit further to go to get. So they're competing on a world stage and didn't industrialize in anticipation of what it would take just to fight in that global fighting ring of resources, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of starts to put them on the beginning of their general decline.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1800s, they pick up a very famous name. The Ottoman Empire becomes the sick man of Europe.
Mm.
You'll hear that in pretty much every textbook, every history class that talks about the Ottoman Empire, is that the 1800s, they're the sick man of Europe. Cultural conflict doesn't help things, especially when you're trying to reform a lot of your infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do they lack the skilled artisans and educated people to pull off the reforms and improvements in infrastructure, but there's actively people pushing against progress on traditional grounds. There's people who are like, no, we want to stay true to our roots. We don't want to do this industrialization. Yeah. We've already held off long enough. Or some people who are like, okay, I get that we have to industrialize with technology, but do we have to give up this to do it? This cultural aspect, this practice. And being from so many different ethnic groups and having control over so many geographic spaces that all have different beliefs, mm-hmm. this is inherently going to fracture them about what each place wants. And that means you also can't make blanket rules as easily, because someone's going to be like, that's against my religion, or that's against my tradition. And other people might be totally fine with it. So that's just going to inherently mess things up for you. And it doesn't help that the European powers around the Ottoman Empire are getting markedly stronger, which makes it very obvious they aren't. It's like someone looks tall until they go stand next to, like, LeBron James.
Right.
And then you're like, you are not that tall. right. And that's kind of what happens. They're like,
okay, 6'2 is average.
Yeah. Everyone is like, oh, the Ottoman Empire, this huge place, all of a sudden, next to Europe and all these expanding powers and industrialization, they're not looking so hot. Maybe they're not quite as strong as we thought.
Yeah.
And it leads some people to really undermine them politically, which I'll get into a little bit more later. But they just can't form that cohesive loyalty to their country. Mm-hmm. And some historians do believe that even if the Ottoman Empire had survived World War I, that they were made up of too many diverse groups and cultures, that at that point, even with access to a form of radio, phones, all that access to modern technology that they would have had, it could not have unified their cultures enough to inspire loyalty to the Ottoman Empire as a whole.
I think the days of empires built like that are probably over.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. You've never thought of it that way?
Not as a result of technology.
Well, I don't even know if it's technology.
But no, they're, like, you're not wrong.
Because, like, the abilities that allowed countries to act like that and conquer like that
don't exist anymore under our current technological
and then not to mention, like, you know, Geneva Conventions and all of those things where we explicitly are, like, not allowing.
Well, and it's funny because, like, there are some very empirical practices. So I mean, technically America could be considered empirical for the way we treat, like, Puerto Rico, holdings we have, and the way we fight for resources and have proxy wars. Like, there's some very imperialistic tendencies, but I'd never thought about, like, the technology really could be considered the death of the empire.
The empire.
Wow. Huh. Interesting. Sorry, you gave me pause there. That was interesting. So, yes. A lot of historians think they always would have split. There just wasn't enough unification or loyalty to the Ottoman Empire to make people stay. And honestly, maybe they were just thinking things through, like, hey, we were conquered. Why would we be loyal to this dude?
Yeah.
It's very interesting that the Ottoman Empire is known for its religious freedoms up to a certain point. We'll get into that later. But, like, religious tolerance was kind of a thing in the Ottoman Empire, which is not unheard of, but it is a little more rare in this context.
It is, but we always see that's how you make an empire last. If you want an empire you have to unify
the cultural practices. And the Ottoman Empire had not instilled a singular language, economy of, like economic system that would hold things stable across all of them. Of course, there's always, like, currency exchange. Like, they had a concept of what was worth what and everything, but between not having one singular required religion, like we saw with the Inca, I believe, that we were talking about, that had the single, they had a one singular language, which made it possible to, like, communicate on their huge, over their huge stretch of land.
That is Inca, yes. Yeah, okay. But language is one thing, religion is another. People get pissed when you start taking their religion away.
That is very true.
So if you want a big empire to last, you can't fuck with people's religion.
You can't. But you do need some sort of unifying factor.
There has to be something that makes you a cohesive empire.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My headphones just died. Sorry. So, yes, those are all things that are going to inevitably make this a lot more difficult for everyone. So does the Crimean War. We have not touched the Crimean War, I don't think, this whole time.
And you know what? Personally, I don't
want to. That's for a reason.
So you can do that if you need to.
don't put that on my shit list.
That one, there's definitely a reason why.
Yeah. I'm just going to say that happens from 1853 to 56.
Even just hearing about it, I'm like,
it's so much. But that really stretches, I mean, they're involved, so the Ottoman Empire has further strain on their resources. Mm-hmm. But in 1856, the Ottoman Empire is recognized as independent by the Congress of Paris. Whether or not, you know, that means anything to the global sphere is very different, but mm-hmm. they at least were recognized by a large entity. And as we head into the late 1800s, there's a sultan named Abdulhamid, I believe is pronounced, mm-hmm. in charge. And he's got a little bit of, like, an authoritarian vibe to him. As, you know, most emperors and sultan, not every sultan, but, like, most emperors and single
leaders like that
tend to have. And the people had gotten a little bit not so fond of him. They'd been a little bit restless and more rebellious into the 1870s when this guy's in power. So that push and pull, they decided, okay, these people really aren't happy. We're going to allow Bulgaria and some of our other countries to be independent. They will no longer technically be under the control of the Ottoman Empire. But then those countries are kind of like, hey, can we have a little more territory? And they kind of want a little more. And they keep pushing for a little more. And if you give an inch, they take a mile, kind of falls into place here. But in response to all of this restlessness and everyone kind of starting to want their independence, especially when... Mm-hmm. Again, in a world context, colonialism is heavy at this point.
Yeah.
We are in the age of, like slavery in some places still. We are talking about imperial powers, colonization. Mm-hmm. People around the world aren't happy with being subject to another empire and all that. So in response to all this, another group rises up, a group known as the Young Turks.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually caused the Young Turk Revolution of 1908.
Mm-hmm.
The result is this sort of ministry group that wants to reform things in the Ottoman Empire, but they somehow want to do that while still retaining control of all the different pieces of that empire from the capital. Mm-hmm. So everyone, all your citizens are still like, so what changed? You still have all this central power, and you're still lording over us and making decisions for us.
Right.
This isn't the revolution we were all kind of hoping for.
Yeah, yeah. It's just someone, a different dude doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you start seeing individual nationalistic ideas mm-hmm. popping up individually in separate places based on their geography and culture.
Yeah.
This dude, they do manage to depose him, Abdulhamid, by 1909, which, great job, guys. Kudos. love a good revolution. But there is this generation, however rebellious and strong and unified, or actually not unified and disjointed across their different cultures they might be, we have a problem. We have a massive problem
mm-hmm.
for the future of the Ottoman Empire. Education. I have a hard time believing that as we turn into the 19th century, this statistic is 100% correct. But then again, thinking about how scattered an infrastructure would have to be to amass this much space, I guess it's a considerable. I found statistics that said they attempted to expand literacy at this point. They had made education an important part of their new stance and what they were encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
But it's estimated by the stats that I found that by 1914, less than 10% of their population could read.
Oh.
And that is not a skill that only affects one profession.
Right.
That is not like that's great. If it means you have tradesmen who can do like really cool work and everything, but they're missing out on that too. They don't have like tradesmen.
Yeah. And you could have gotten away with that at one point in world history, but not anymore.
As you're turning into the 1900s, that means like there's no vocational work that you can learn
mm-hmm.
like by being hands-on, like carpentry and stuff like that. That's all incredibly important, but literacy affects everything from doctors
that's how
academics.
You advance like that
that's, and especially when the world is as globalized as this mm-hmm. and one of the main ways they're doing this is through we've had the printing press for a while now.
Yeah.
Like, that, it comes down to religion. It comes down to being able to read your own religious texts. It's about being able to think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It is about doctors read, academics read. Army officers cannot function if they cannot read communications to each other.
Right.
So, like, literacy is a huge factor in this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have good literacy, you don't have good education.
Yeah.
And that is a generational thing, too. It is incredibly difficult if you are at a disadvantage for learning, especially when learning is still very much a domestic thing
mm-hmm.
and it is expected to be enhanced at home. And you can still see that now, that there are entire systemic groups that have been systemically preyed upon because they were not given access to a good, strong educational foundation. Mm-hmm. And it still shows in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And without efforts to even that out, to kind of, to, what's the word I'm looking for? To make up for a lack of previous education, like, you can see that it still affects generationally how people have access to enrichment at home and everything. So,
yeah,
it's a huge problem for them. And, I'm just trying to think about, like, that's Downton Abbey. Like, slightly pre-Downton Abbey by a few years. But, like, no, that actually is Downton Abbey. I think Downton Abbey starts with the sinking of the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And that's 1912. Yeah. 1912. And that's, so we're talking Downton Abbey. 10%, 1 out of 10 people or less were
That's reading. Like an incredibly low number.
Yes. It's a worrisomely low number.
That's not just like, oh, well, you know, not everyone gets to go to school. That's like, there is something functionally wrong
with your infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that rebellious group of kids who can't read and everyone's having a grand old time. They get a little too big for their britches. Everyone does. Everyone starts rebelling. Everyone starts saying, like, hey, I want a piece of that. I want a piece of that. Let me expand. Give me my own power and everything. Mm-hmm. And the Ottoman Empire hits the Balkan Wars. The Balkan Wars...
Hit after hit.
Yeah. This almost establishes the Ottoman Empire as a integral strength. This is its doom, almost. Mm-hmm. Historians have argued whether or not if the Balkan Wars hadn't happened and World War One had, like, what, how things would have played out. Again, you can't really speculate this part of history. It is so complex with the World Wars and everything leading into it. But I agree that this is the point, after the Balkan War and the Ottoman Empire is lost in it, it was done.
Yeah.
And that World War II was the nail in the or World War One, sorry, was the nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
We're looking at the early 1900s here, 1912 through 1913 specifically. And it's important to acknowledge that while the decline of the Ottoman Empire took a while, we're talking the last couple minutes I've been talking about, that's over hundreds of years. The actual dissolution, like the breaking of it apart, not just in strength, but the physical fracturing of its control, is marked pretty clearly between the years of 1908 and 1922. Starting with that Young Turk Revolution that I mentioned and ending with the founding of modern Turkey. And that's what we're about to hit. So the Balkan Wars are incredibly complicated. There are so many moving players, so many moving parts that if I was to explain it, we would be here for three episodes. And this is not an episode about the Balkan Wars. You know why? Because I don't want to talk about the Balkan Wars.
No one wants to talk about the Balkan Wars.
We don't want to talk about the Crimean War. We don't want to talk about the Balkan Wars. No one wants to.
We are not war historians.
And I frankly don't think y'all want to hear about the Balkan Wars. No. So I'm going to give you a summary as best I can.
Oh, from the. God, you are brave.
This is going to be a very poor, convoluted you're gonna summary do great. Of the you're Balkan gonna do Wars. Great. Thank you. I've seen so many memes about how no one actually understands the Balkan Wars. like everyone just pretends that they know, like, what's actually going
what's
on.
What's that, like, whatever that was.
Yeah. No one truly understands the Balkan Wars except for people who, like, specialize in it specifically. At the end of the day, it's caused because all these people had all these different nationalistic sympathies and there were too many groups who just wanted their independence. So all of these kind of warring nations that had been mad at the Ottoman Empire, their focus had been on, like, the empire itself. They kind of finally look side to side and go, oh, we've been fighting with each other. Why don't we fight together? What a thought. Never thought of that one before. And they realize they've got a common enemy. Stop squabbling amongst yourselves and just go after the big dude together.
Right.
And they kind of do. So the first Balkan War, there's two, just so y'all know, there's two, which makes this incredibly annoying.
Of course there's two. Of course there is.
The Balkan League is made up of Serbia, Greece, Bulgaria, and Montenegro mainly. And they're facing off against the Ottoman Empire, which is obviously run by the Ottoman Empire. So the original formation of the Balkan League goes back to 1912. They're trying to focus mainly, there's a lot of motivations and end goals here, but what they're trying, what their kind of flagship argument is to get Macedonia away from Turkey. And they come up with about 750,000 men, troops, to do it between the Balkan League. Montenegro declares war first on Turkey. And the other members of the Balkan League quickly follow. It takes like 10 days for them to all be like, oh, yep, dominoes are falling. We all go. We ride at dawn. And it is a shockingly small amount of time that it takes the Balkan allies to actually come out on top. Hmm. To just, like, up against Turkey, they're like, hey, give us this land. And Turkey shockingly realizes they're outmatched, which is not very common for people, for empires that are kind of big for their britches. They don't always acknowledge that early on. Yeah. But relatively quickly, Turkey's like, okay, they have to scramble to react, obviously, but they had just been, you know, thoroughly kicked in the butt. And they cede to an armistice agreement on December 3rd of 1912. Same year, same, like a couple months later, like it's pretty quick. Mm-hmm. This should have theoretically concluded with a peace conference in London, where they all agree and go on their merry ways. But there's a little rebellion of the young Turks in Constantinople a month later, and it throws it all to the wind, and they're just going to fight again. Mm-hmm. And so, armistice, out the door. They're back to war. Goes on for a few more months. Bunch of complicated military stuff, but they eventually do sign a peace treaty on May of 1913. That's the next year, a few months later, right as we're about to head into the First World War. Like, we're getting close. Tensions are rising. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Balkan Wars are known to be a very important influence in the World War. But what's important about the Balkan War is just the results. It's not even so much... And that's why in history classes you often gloss over the actual Balkan Wars, right. Because it's not the war that matters. Matter.
Yeah.
It's... what happened, it's like, because
and then they fought each other. All you need to know is this is why they did it, and this is what happened after.
Exactly.
And that's a lot of wars are like that.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the result of this, the Ottoman Empire loses pretty much all of its European holdings. That's Albania, that's Macedonia, and that's a huge blow to their empire.
Yeah.
And of course, people are still pissed. So a few months later, we get into the Second Balkan War. Albania had been given the go-ahead by the European nations to become independent on its own.
Okay.
They were like, yeah, you've got... Okay, yeah, fine. But Macedonia was supposed to be split up among the allies and of those who fought for it, of the Balkan League. Problem is, they can't quite agree on how to divvy it up and who gets what resources and spaces. Serbia, Greece, Romania, and Bulgaria are all fighting, essentially, to see who gets what chunk of Macedonia.
Uh-huh.
Starts with a certain level of intrigue when Serbia and Greece actually join up against Bulgaria. Oh. They're like, aha, et tu but. And King Ferdinand orders his Bulgarian troops to attack Serbian and Greek forces in Macedonia on the very late night of June 29th of 1913. At first, it was kind of promising for Bulgaria. They had the element of surprise, and they had good troops and everything, but the Greek and Serbian soldiers managed to pull together enough and quickly enough that the Serbians and Greeks can regroup. Like, this is in no means like, aha, we were ready for you. This is like, okay, we're holding our own. And all the fancy military tactics I could tell you aside... they kind of focus, like, I could give you all the names in that, but at the end of the day, I'm just going to tell you, they try to break the Bulgarians off from their resources, because that's how you win a war.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that a bit with World War I in the context of the Ottoman Empire, but they just want to make sure that the Bulgarians can't access their supply lines and extra troops. This causes, when they kind of try to, when the Serbians and Greeks try to kind of box them in so that they can't get their resources, the Bulgarians essentially lash out. They make kind of a last-ditch attempt against the Serbs and their military with some limited success at first, but then they get pushed back again. Mm-hmm. It gets even more messy because the Turks get involved. The Turks, who had, like, just been like, okay, fine, like, y'all can have Albania and Macedonia, whatever. They're going to jump in, but that kind of voids their armistice with Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. And it does eventually... The Turk involvement is what forces... power-wise, the Bulgarians to back down and give in, and they eventually sign an armistice on August 10th of 1913. So this is all happening a matter of pretty quick months.
Yeah. And, like, right before World War I.
Yes, yes. And most of Macedonia gets split up. Bulgaria gets a tiny little cut of it, but it's to them, it's an insultingly small, tiny little cut of it. Mm-hmm. It does not help that throughout this whole process, throughout rebellions, the Balkan Wars, the unification of the like certain states against others, the European powers know what's going on. They want to weaken the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
They want their resources. They're
like, we're not going to fight this.
They're going to, in fact, they're going to actually basically low-key support the smaller groups and sects that they think could work eventually in their favor. This is very Game of Thrones-esque. This is very like, which house will I support now to, and to, that will take the throne. It's a betting game, really, for them.
Yeah.
And it's subversive, and it weakens not only the countries they wanted to, but the Ottoman Empire as a whole. This is not, Europe is just going to be able to swoop in. Like, this is going to collapse an empire. And they were playing a very dangerous game and throwing support behind people that they were, I don't think they fully understood the consequences of what it would mean to throw their support at individual nationalistic groups. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about it before, too, in other episodes. Nationalism is on the rise.
Yep.
It has been on the rise.
Yeah.
Colonialization and imperialism had a part in that. It's not just a, oh, going into World War II, Germany got really nationalist. No. Yeah. Nationalism as an ideology has been prevalent almost everywhere in the world to this point. And this European support of nationalist ideology in these areas is going to come back heavily later. Yeah. Yes, essentially, when Turkey, my brain got a little scrambled there. A lot. Balkan Wars will do that far, to you.
So
thank you.
You're doing way better than I would, so I'm impressed.
Thank you. The Balkan Wars, again, it is not who won and who lost and what got divided. The most significant part of the Balkan Wars is how tense things are now between Austria-Hungary and Serbia. Because what's about to happen? A little princip is about to shoot Franz Ferdinand in the head, and everyone's going to blame everyone, and everyone's going to go to war, and everyone's going to try to kill each other, and the world's literally almost going to end. Like, in the Balkan Wars, the tension that this has built, not just for the Ottoman Empire, which is struggling to stay alive, but now they are struggling to stay alive in the midst of massive conflict, and their land, their holdings, and their resources are cut dead in the middle. You cannot underestimate the geography of where they are at this point. The war will tear them apart. So yes, powder keg, all that jazz we've talked about with Austria, Hungary, Serbia, all that. World War I starts. Arguably, depending on how you see the Balkan Wars versus leading into World War I and everything, this is it for the Ottomans. Their nail in the coffin, their death note to themselves, was siding with the Germans. And they get involved in 1914 to side with Germany, which may have... It is the last domino. It is the biggest mistake they could make. The thing is, they had secretly signed a treaty with Germany before the war. And that's another part of the huge tension going on in the rest of the world. Because people know where alliances sit on the global scale going into World War I. They know who's going to side with who. They know that, oh, if I attack so-and-so. And that's why so many world leaders were so tentative. Because they knew if we attack this one thing, these five other countries, these other empires are going to come at us too. And the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand throws that all in the water. It throws it overboard. And it's just chaos. And technically, it had been a secret treaty with Germany, but people kind of knew where the Ottoman Empire sat in their alliances, who they would support. And you remember before when I said that they hadn't really industrialized and they were mostly agrarian? They don't have the ability or facilities to produce war machines or metal or things that are actually going to help the war effort. I mean, yes, the war effort could argue, it could be said that wars are won also on food resources because your army can't starve. But like, this is a new kind of warfare. We have never seen the need for industrialization in war until this point, really. And Ottoman Empire can't step up.
I mean, there's only so far that, like, swords are going to go versus guns. Like,
Especially when we're technology. Getting into, like, automatic weapons and early tanks and, the Ottoman Empire itself during World War I, we see an incredibly bloody campaign as one of their most notable events. They had put a lot of their forces on the Gallipoli. Oh my god, I can never say that word. That peninsula. I'm not even going to try to say it. It's just embarrassing. It's like how I can't say the word alcohol. to try and keep hold of Constantinople. Which is now, well, Istanbul is Constantinople. Anyway, between 19...
I knew that you were going to bring that song up.
I had to. I'm talking about the Ottoman Empire. And for some reason, I love that song way too much. So, yeah, they were trying to hold on to Constantinople between 1915 and 16.
Yeah.
When the Allied forces were trying to take it.
I mean, because that's what Constantinople is a pretty prized pig,
It is. Yeah. It's got... Again, look at a map for this one. It'll help you understand. But, like, the proximity and the space it's in... And also, if you look at a map, you'll understand why this whole freaking empire is so important.
This is, I will say, a map is very helpful just for understanding both of our topics.
Yeah.
Like,
pulling up.
Just go ahead and do that yourself that favor, because, yeah.
But Constantinople is not only a very symbolic place. It's got a massive history of world leaders, of some of the greatest progress humanity has made has been in Constantinople, but it's also just very strategic as far as access to everything around it.
There is a reason why it's such a, like, sought highly, after.
Because
it's, I mean, again, look at a map at where it is, you will see exactly why.
Yes.
Like, it is.
Yeah. You need it to get access almost, to any water, to any,
It is almost, like, the perfectly situated city.
People, I mean, people built it where they did for a reason. During the World War I campaigns, the Ottoman Empire lost what is estimated to be about 500,000 soldiers, most of which actually succumbed to disease.
Oh, interesting.
And sickness. We see that's not uncommon in previous wars, but it's not as uncommon. It's not as common in modern wars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the whole thing about the Civil War in America. Most of our soldiers didn't die from fighting. Soldiers died from sickness and disease.
Yeah.
So somewhere around 3.8 million Ottoman soldiers were injured or fell ill. So didn't die, but, like, obviously that's a huge chunk of their population. They were reduced to such a situation that they actually signed an armistice with Great Britain to quit the war.
On like, October, we want out.
They had to be like, I'm out.
I'm tapping out.
They really did. In October of 1918, official armistice day comes on November 11th of 1918. So it wasn't very far before they almost held out to the end.
Yeah.
But at some point they're like, their leaders at least were like, we can't do, we're out. You've pushed us too far. Notably, the rivalry that destroys them actually destroys both sides of this rivalry has been Russia. They had been duking it out. They had had rising tensions for years, and they were each other's biggest potential enemies going into this war. They had a lot of, I mean, proximity-wise and everything, resources. They had a lot that they could be in competition for. And they were on opposing sides in World War One. Obviously, the Ottoman Empire had sided with Germany. Russia was with the Allies. And this is when it's really important to remember what World Wars were about. It was not about winning a war. It is about who can last the longest.
Yeah.
Who has enough resources to stay on their feet and keep sending troops forward before they're all just dead.
Yeah.
And the Ottomans actually hold out longer than Russia. And in large part, the Ottoman Empire is the reason that Russia folded earlier than they did. Because all that great stuff we talked about, geography and access to water, Russia can't get supplies from Europe.
Yeah.
They can't get backup. They can't get resources. They can't get help. And that's why Russia folds before the Ottomans, because the Ottomans were actively blocking their access to the necessary resources.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I did not know this, that at one point it was suggested to Tsar Nicholas II, who was running Russia at the time, to negotiate separately with the Ottoman Empire and broker an agreement just to get supplies through them, to, like, approach them one-on-one and be like, hey, I know we're on different sides of a war right now, but dude, we're all gonna die.
Can you do me a solid?
Like, really? Of course, Tsar Nicholas didn't do this. Nicholas II did not. He was proud, and also, not even just he's a proud man, but, like, how would that look to the rest of the world? Right. And what would that mean? There's so many other implications.
And like, alliance is really complicated. And
yeah. And, yeah. And that would undermine the whole idea of alliances. Because who's fighting for who if we're allowed to ask each other for
favors?
Resources. Yeah. Yeah. So he doesn't do it. But some historians actually argue that Russia might have outlasted them if they'd just been able to get resources. I mean,
yeah.
Think about the size of Russia.
Yeah.
Like, they might have been able to hold out a lot longer than the Ottomans did. But when the Ottomans are defeated in the war, everyone's already pushing a sort of Turkish nationalism, and they get even more mad when post-war results are laid out. Treaties that ended the war essentially dissolved all their territories to be reabsorbed into other areas. Namely, it's the Treaty of Sevres, I think it's pronounced.
Sure.
But it breaks the Ottoman Empire apart.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the punishment, almost. But with such a rising nationalism,
you can't do that.
You can't.
We learned that the hard way.
Yeah, they're about to learn it the hard way. Jeez. Turkish nationalists are really peeved when it hits 1920, and they've already been split and everything. The Ottoman space has been decimated. They've been sequestered. And they have a new form of government. What little land they have left would be considered essentially an Ottoman caliphate, kind of like how the Vatican has.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, the last sultanate is completely dissolved by Mustafa Kemal, aka Ataturk.
Uh-huh.
You probably know first.
Yeah.
Who comes to power in Turkey, forcing the last Ottoman sultan, which was Mehmed the, I believe, fourth, to be deposed. And this is a couple years after the war, but Mehmed the Fourth essentially flees Constantinople, which became Istanbul eventually, in 1922 by boarding a British warship.
Yeah,
he flees. He's got to get out of there. And a year later, in 1923, we see Mustafa Kemal Ataturk proclaim the Republic of Turkey, which creates the modern Turkey as we know it, a whole new political structure, and Ataturk becomes the first president.
Mm, okay.
You can really see those other influences there, other world influences who are like, president. That sounds great. We all love presidents.
Yeah.
And that creates Turkey as we know it and ends the Ottoman Empire. So some historians really debate, you can see why, with that national sentiment between individual groups, if it ever could have survived past, if it was just going to fall apart slowly in a myriad of different little wars, if the World War One massive collapse hadn't just happened.
Right. And with empires that are so huge in all of this stuff and have this great history, it's almost like one thing, unless it's like a freaking nuke.
Yeah.
Like, it's never just going to be one thing.
No.
So I definitely see why there's a debate. But in my mind, it probably would have just kind of faded into obscurity.
Yeah. I mean, and we see that with other imperialistic powers throughout the 1900s as we start to, they start to not decentralize, but like they start to realize like, oh God,
we can't do that.
Never mind. Yeah. Everyone's got to stop taking each other over. it keeps causing world wars. Calm down.
Yeah.
And the legacy that the Ottoman Empire leaves is a very mixed one. Mm-hmm. Towards the end there are some bad things.
Yeah.
Really bad things that literally you cannot talk about in Turkey anymore.
Mm.
It is illegal to talk about certain things in Turkey that I will be covering next week.
Oh,
so
what a cliffhanger.
We probably if we were gonna get like pulled from something, we might actually get pulled for that episode. Like we might not be able to I don't know if that'll be a problem to have that. I mean, there's other topics about things like the Armenian genocide and everything. I just don't know if that'll be available to people we have listening in that part of the world. I don't know how, I personally do not come from Turkey, so I don't know how strong the censorship actually is about this issue. But next week, I'm going to talk about essentially the genocides that happen. And I do want to warn y'all about that, but that's going to be a heavy topic. And I really was not planning to touch that for, I didn't know if I was ever going to touch that, honestly, because that's one of the more brutal things you could talk about in history. But it is really important as we talk about what the full effects of the Ottoman Empire were and why the nationalism and the way it dissolved is so important, because it isn't just Germany that's looking for a fight as we get into World War II. It's everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah, next week I will be talking
about
that.
Thanks for the warning.
Warning on that.
Yeah, and just so you know, knowing that, I'll be sure to do something fun.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, that's probably a good balance. Yeah.
I already was... There was already something that I was like, "Ooh, that would be fun." So okay. I'll pull a fun one.
Awesome.
So
I was
we'll
like
a lighthearted one.
I was like reading over everything, and I was like, "I cannot, in good conscience, just talk about the end of the Ottoman Empire and not talk about."
There are certain things, as much as we don't want to talk about them, you have to.
Yeah.
In history, and it would be a disservice not to.
Yeah, and I'll try my best to be really respectful of it and everything. Yeah. But it is a brutal time in history, and to fully understand, because. This is the end for the Ottomans. Like I said, this is the one of the longest empires in history.
Yeah.
Goes out with a, not like a bang, but like a horrible bang.
Yeah.
Committing some of the worst atrocities that we have seen in recent history.
Yeah. No, I think it's important that you talk about that. Yeah. It's going to suck.
And the thing is, the legacy of the Ottoman Empire is one of military prowess and just expansive growth and culture and decadent, just... beautiful culture and art, and to have something that we don't talk about that often, that doesn't get talked about that often because some schools won't teach it, like some schools you don't even mention it,
right?
My public school didn't mention it ever. I never once remember hearing about the Armenian genocide.
I feel like we touched on it, but we talked about
the term may have been mentioned, but I've never,
yeah,
I did not
we never
know what
went
it was
into
until
like
college.
It was just kind of like, and then they did genocide,
yeah,
and then they did this,
yeah.
And it's like,
and
okay.
it's not fair to the people who died as a result of that to just remember the Ottoman Empire as its height. The Ottoman Empire is so much more than just that, So, I'll be talking about that next week, but the legacy that it leaves behind is one of surprisingly early on religious tolerance, diversity of ethnic and geographic and cultural groups that they were assimilating and didn't completely force to assimilate to their own cultures and everything. Art that they produced, architecture that is so unique to this empire. Like the Ottoman Empire is so fascinating, and it's almost even more fascinating to me to see an empire slowly dig its own grave. That is many, but not even all, the factors of the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Jeez. Well, you did a fantastic job. That's a big topic.
Thank
and
you.
Just the fact that you were able to get all those countries straight in your head.
Did I?
It sounded like it to me. So good job. Good job.
Thank
Brava.
You. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Snaps for a cat.
Yes.
Yeah. Whew.
Whew. Yeah, that one wasn't as heavy as it could be. It was still heavy, but we're going to get really heavy next week, so sorry about that, guys.
Yeah, no, thanks for the heads up. I think, you know, people will appreciate it, and I definitely do, because, like I said, I will be sure to do something a little bit more lighthearted and easygoing.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, quick recommendations then, and we can jump ahead.
So I can do mine.
Go for
and
it.
Give you a little bit of a talking break here. I am going to recommend a podcast that I stumbled across doing research for my topic today. It's called it's half-assed history, but it's in like the arst way, but I hate saying that as an American.
Half-assed.
I can't say it right.
I love that word.
But it's spelled like arst. I it's like fun to hear, but as an American, it just does not sound right. Coming out of my
American
mouth. It
took me a long time
mouth.
Reading Harry Potter to realize that that's what that meant.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that as a kid either.
I was like,
what are they talking
word?
About? Like,
yeah.
But it's by this dude. I think he's Australian. That's what the accent sounded like. And I was so blown away because he did such a fantastic job. Like,
so it was not, in fact, half-arsed.
Yeah, no, I was like, dude, good. I don't know what you're talking about, because this is like one of the best history podcasts I've listened to.
Ooh, okay.
And that's like why I'm recommending it. And he's still making episodes. He's at like 250.
Oh, awesome.
Does
he have a Twitter we can follow?
I don't know.
I want to know who this dude is.
Yeah. The way he explained this event, and it makes me believe that the way he explained any events that he covered was just so well done. And it really, really succinctly put like the context of it and everything. And I was so impressed. And then if you know history and you've been through like history classes and, you know, you've listened to podcasts and stuff, you can tell when people really just understand how history works and functions mm-hmm. versus someone just like reading facts off a page.
Right.
And he is definitely of the former group. Like I was just really, really impressed. So
I'll have to give it a listen.
I would recommend that podcast. I enjoyed it a lot. And I looked on, cause I was also interested. So I like pulled up the website because he had mentioned that he had merch and I was like, I want to go see what this guy's merch looks like.
Ooh.
And there was one shirt that I was like, holy shit, that's really cool.
Ooh, okay.
It was like, it like, you know, like the old like lithograph prints where they have like the stripies and everything for shading. It was a skull with a crown on it. And then at the, like the text read like, and it just gets worse from here or something like that. And I was like, that's a fucking cool shirt.
I'm looking this up right now.
Yeah, so definitely would recommend it. And I was very, very, very pleasantly surprised. His last episode was on Guy Fawkes, so.
Do you know what I had on my topic list for next week if I hadn't done the Armenian genocide? Yes! No, it's I've literally been... sitting on my, oh yeah. No. Oh, I gotta change it now. Oh dear.
Well, I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, we'll do it in November. What are you talking
That's
about?
That's true.
Yeah.
I was finally going to get the guts to do the whole gunpowder plot and everything.
No. You got to say, that one is so iconic. You have to save it for November.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that is cool.
Did you see the shirt?
Yes.
Isn't it so cool? Yeah. So that's my recommendation for the week.
I'm going to steal your recommendation from earlier because it is a good rec.
Yeah.
Kunk on Earth.
Is it Kunk on Earth?
I think that's
Kunk
what it is.
Or Kunk on History?
No, I think it's Kunk on Earth.
I think you're right.
I think it's Kunk on Earth. Yeah.
It's on Netflix.
It's such satire, but also like so cool.
The way she delivers, it's so funny. And it's almost like she's just so serious about it that I believe her.
I know.
I'm like, oh my God.
But it's actually kind of a fun way to learn.
Yeah, it really
is. It's like nature documentaries that have that really, what's the one where they have that really sarcastic British guy?
I know what you're talking about, where they have like a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah, and he's like, all these jellyfish have a brain cell. Like my roommate. And I'm just like, it's like that like cool stuff. I love it.
Ugh. Yeah, it's great. There's something about British humor that it's just,
it's great. Yeah.
It is Kunk on Earth. Yeah, you're right.
Okay. So yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Good rep. But that means we get to jump into yours and I don't know what you're talking about.
And I have teased it enough. And I am so glad that you mentioned the importance of Constantinople. Because guess what I'm doing?
Are you talking about
1453, yes! Baby! The fall of Constantinople!
God bless. Thank you so much for doing this.
This is like the history topic.
This is.
Like, this is among, like, if you look up a list of,
this
like,
is the fall of Rome.
Most important things in history, this is going to be on the list every time.
This is with Library of Alexandria, like, fall of Rome. Like, this is it, guys.
This is big, heavy hit in history. And since we're talking about the Ottomans, I was like, well, if there was ever a time to do it.
Beautiful.
Because I've always been kind of, this has always kind of caught my attention in like history and stuff, in class and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always kind of been on my list to do. And I'm glad that I was, you know, given an excuse to do it. You seem very excited.
I am. I'm actually just really excited.
I had such a fun time. Well.
I should preface this with, this is a topic that did not get covered adequately in any of my public school classes. And then I never got a chance to take a class in college about this topic. So this is something that, like, I want to know. Learn me today.
Let's get right into it. I texted Kat earlier today. I was like, be warned. Mine literally has, and I looked, 2.5 pages of context. Because you have to understand the different factors going into
this. When you said that, I was kind of like, oh, shoot. Like, what is she doing? I was like, like, what event? But a fall of a city has to have context.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And especially a city as important as Constantinople. Because it's just one of those things.
This song will be running in my head all night.
I know. I'm sorry.
I want this song running in my head all night.
When I was typing up the notes and I had to write out Constantinople a million times.
I started abbreviating it in mine. I just wrote Connie.
Yeah. I should have. But it's got so many of the repeating letters but somehow I managed to hit it every time.
Yeah.
I don't think I spelled it wrong once.
I was writing Otto by the end of it. I was like, Otto, Connie, Massey.
Yeah. I know. I was thinking. I was like, Kat's gonna talk about that song.
Oh, I am.
Okay. So we have to start off with context. I'm going to start with what Constantinople is itself. And this is where I really recommend.
No wonder you said to look at a map.
Looking at a map. I know. I was like, I have to hold off. Because I was like, should I drop it now? Should I say?
No, you need a map.
You guys are going to want a map. And it's helpful to look at a modern day map of Istanbul. But it's also really helpful to look at specifically a map of Constantinople in 1453. So just a little background. By 1453, Constantinople had existed for over 1,000 years. It was founded by Roman Emperor Constantine I in 324 CE and acted as the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, which would come to be known as the Byzantine Empire for, again, over 1,000 years.
It's like one of the longest lasting cities. It's got to be.
Yeah. And in all of that time, it was not sacked one time. That is the legacy of Constantinople, and that is what the Ottomans are daring to take on in 1453.
That's like part of its gimmick, right? Is because of where it is and the way it was built. It was essentially like King's Landing from Game of Thrones. Like it was
like impenetrable, like known the defenses, as the unsackable city. Like, okay, you could not, and people tried over and over again.
Yeah,
you could not. It was like they had just. I'll get into it. So the city itself is located essentially on a peninsula. If you look at a modern day map, they've overtaken more of that area where they are. But back in 1453, it was kind of they had this like triangle shape of land, and they were bordered on one side by what is now like southern Bulgaria, like the part of Turkey that's southern south of Bulgaria, because there's like a little bit of Turkey that comes into Europe, and it's like that land south of Bulgaria is the land that is like forming the landed side of the peninsula.
Okay.
And then on the water side, we have it's called the Golden Horn. It's like basically an elongated bay, like really long, kind of pointy at the end, and that comes out of the Strait of Bosphorus, the Bosphorus Strait that connects the Sea of, what is it called? I think it's Marmara. Yeah. Marmara and the Black Sea. And the Sea of Marmara is what connects the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean Sea through the Bosphorus Strait to the Black Sea. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm looking for the Golden Horn to make sure I have this.
Yeah. This is why it's just really helpful for this.
Date of St. Barbara. Okay. Yeah.
For this, and just like, because that comes into play later, it's helpful to have a visual to be like, okay, I know what's going on.
Yeah.
So on the two sea sides, we have the Sea of Marmara and then the Golden Horn. And then you have like a little bit of flat land that actually is like right on the Bosphorus Strait itself. This is an incredibly strategic location because this connects the Baltic Sea and therefore the rest of the east with the Mediterranean.
Otherwise, you got to go all the way around
and you can't go really through the land.
Not really.
So this is an incredibly strategic location for any city. Like, this is prize point. And because of the Bosphorus Strait, that means you are rich because you are getting taxes off of every boat that comes in and out of that. Jeez. So not only is it incredibly, like, just economically strategic, it's also incredibly politically strategic, because whoever controls Constantinople or Istanbul decides who gets to come in and out of the Black Sea.
Okay.
Which, especially when you're talking 1453, is incredibly powerful. Like, you have a lot of power sitting right there.
Right.
So where am I? I don't want to get ahead of myself because
I know that's the risk.
I have to take it like step by step. So the thing about Constantinople is it has these walls, very famously. It's surrounded actually on all three sides by walls, but the walls that are on the sea are like weaker.
Okay.
And they're not really the walls that Constantinople is known for. But the fact that they are not only relying on just the sea to be that natural barricade, but also they're like, we're going to go ahead and build some walls anyway.
Yeah. Just be safe.
Just be safe. Really makes it hard to attack them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it makes it hard. They have that extra added layer of protection. The walls that they are known for are the Theodosian walls. These were built in 500 CE by Emperor Theodosius II. And were, whatever they did, whatever like engineer worked on these walls, they were unmatched.
Okay.
Like, however they made these walls, they, even when they first were conceived, basically untouchable.
Okay.
And of course they've been expanded and added on and all of that stuff throughout the close to 1,000 years that right. they were there. But these walls were like hands down the reason why okay. you could not sack Constantinople.
Okay.
I'm going to, okay, so not only were there walls, I'm going to quote from World History Encyclopedia in a minute, but I want to talk about them.
I love World History
Encyclopedia. I love it too. I was going to mention they are doing a fundraiser for their servers right now.
Okay.
So if you have the means and would like to support, you know, public history and information access, I would encourage you to donate.
They just do so much and they have so much.
I know. And it's so good too. I threw $5 at them, so
yeah, no, seriously.
If you have anything, anything is appreciated and stuff like that. Because I was like, you guys have served me well over the years. Yeah. I'll give you $5 of my dollars.
Yeah.
So these walls, the Theodosian walls, so the walls on the landed side, are also accompanied with a giant moat, like a moat. And this was not flooded all the time, but it could be flooded when they needed to.
Of course.
This moat was 65 feet wide
Are
by
you kidding
23
me?
Feet deep.
Are you
this
kidding
me? This thing is huge.
It's a lake. That's not even a moat. That's a river.
And I'm like, well, no wonder they don't keep it flooded all the time.
Yeah.
Because that would be totally impractical.
Jeez.
And if you're in meters land, that's 20 by 7 meters. So 27 feet, meters, 20 meters wide and 7 meters deep. So insane. So this is a quote about how the walls were built from World History Encyclopedia, because I cannot explain this myself. So, quote, behind the moat, there was an outer wall which had a patrol track to oversee the moat. Behind this was a second wall which had regular towers and an interior terrace as to provide a firing platform to shoot down on enemy forces attacking the moat and the first wall. Then behind that wall was a third, much more massive inner wall. This final defense was almost 5 meters or 16.5 feet thick, 12 meters or 39 feet high, and had a total of 96 projecting towers. Each of these towers was placed around 70 meters or 230 feet distance from each other and were over 65 feet tall or 20 meters tall. These could hold up to three artillery machines. So we have three layers of wall, each of them built for defense and attack. Checks out. Okay. Not to mention the construction of these walls was just impressive. These walls were built before the existence of like gunpowder weapons.
Yeah.
And were able to hold
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I was about to say, to stand up against something that has not been invented yet.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, these walls are just some of the best defensive walls that we see exist in anywhere at this time. So Constantinople, the history of it, for a long time in its history, I mean, it's the capital city of what is essentially the last part of the Roman Empire. The Byzantine Empire was a huge deal at its peak. This city was, again, on like some of the best strategic land. You had all that money coming in from taxes and just being a port city in general. You had, you know, travelers from the east and the west. You had all this wealth of culture and civilization and people. And it really was this kind of like central point of the world for a long time. And its peak population, estimates say that it's anywhere from 800,000 to 1 million people living within these walls. Within Constantinople at the time.
Okay.
So this is a big, big, big city. However, much like the Ottomans, the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, did not fall from just one factor. And
right.
Constantinople did not fall just because one guy decided, I'm going to go get it, you know?
No, it was like, hi, I'm going to wake up today and decide to take Constantinople.
This is another one of those things where it seemed like an inevitability, but the Ottomans just happened to be the one to
land that. No one could do it but them, yeah.
Yeah, land that final blow. So, and that's because of a lot of different factors. The Great Schism of 1054, which is the schism that separates Eastern Orthodox Christianity from Catholicism, meant that essentially the Byzantine Empire is out of favor with the rest of Europe. Mm-hmm. And that is really hard because
back from that.
Yeah, Europe has essentially cut them off. They like literally excommunicate each other. They're like, we're not talking anymore.
And Europe has a shit ton of everything.
Everything. A lot of and resources people. That they just have no access to.
Yeah.
Some of Europe is still friendly with them, but really Europe, especially when it comes to the 1450s, they got their own shit going on. They're not worried about what's going on over in Constantinople. No. They're like, okay, whatever.
They're vibing.
Yeah. And on top of that, now that they've excommunicated each other, that means Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire is the target for, guess what?
Everyone.
The Crusades.
Yep, there it is.
So in 1204, they become the target for the Fourth Crusade. And they were actually, the Crusaders actually managed to overtake the city and occupy it for several decades before they were kicked out. And I want to be clear, and the articles were like, to be clear, this is not a fault of the walls. This was because someone essentially left a door open and they just came in and took it.
So, the walls were so good that even the Crusaders couldn't make it. Yeah. Someone had to use the back door.
I mean, like, that doesn't say a lot. The Crusaders, you know.
Hey, remember the Child's Crusade? The one where, like, all those kids left and then never came back?
Yeah, I try not to think about that. So, just to be clear, this does mean
walls are still strong.
Yeah, this does mean that the Ottomans were quite literally the first ones to actually come through the walls, and even then the walls really stood up to their attack.
Okay,
like, I'll get into it. I would still argue that, like, they didn't actually break the walls. They just sacked,
like,
the
how
city.
We're all just fighting at this point for the respect and the
right. I was the one who took the walls, like, down.
The wall stood.
Yeah, so that obviously incredibly damaging to your population. So any damage done by the Crusaders to the walls was repaired, but the walls from about 1260 to 1450 hadn't really been kept up with, and that's 200 years.
Yeah.
And things decay, so
maintenance work is required. Yeah, at some point
by 1450 they're not in the best shape. They do know that, hey, the Ottomans are coming for us, so they repair what they think is the important parts to repair, so like the landed side, but mm-hmm. the seawalls they kind of ignore, which ends up being
fatal flaw.
Yeah. Also, between the literal crusade that they have to go through and 1450, we have, guess what? The Black Plague. It's also really hard to recover things when a third of your population has died.
What are you talking about?
Disease. Just like the Ottomans, hit after hit, they were on the downward slope. Historians are like, it would have happened eventually, especially considering that by the time, like, our story begins, Constantinople had roughly 50,000 inhabitants. Most of the land within the walls was just kind of like farmland with scattered little, like, villages.
Jeez.
Like, it is.
That's a huge.
Yeah.
Huge population. Uh-huh. Jeez. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's not just like, oh, okay, you know.
That's like, we do not have enough people to do the work we need to survive.
And that is a big, big part of why Constantinople fell at this time. So that's where we are with Constantinople. Let's talk about the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire was founded in the late 13th century by a man named Osman it's a lot of
vowels. Just do your best, you got this.
Eskişehir. And by the 1400s, it was already, so like about 100 years into their existence, they're already kind of stirring up some trouble. They're already posing like a serious threat to basically any land they put their sights on. They're not quite in their heights yet. That would happen with Solomon the Great, which would be like the 16th century. Mm-hmm. But definitely this event and this leader we're talking about, who is the sultan that leads this charge, is kind of that beginning of their upward swing. Like, we see them start to, I mean, it's hard to not be on an upward string when you take Constantinople.
Yeah.
So Okay, so our sultan in question is a man named Mehmed the Second. He was the fourth son, that tripped me up. He was the fourth son, but he was the second.
Nice.
Of his dad, Murad the Second, who was sultan, and a woman, and we think slave and concubine for the sultan, his dad, named Huma Hatun. And he was, for whatever reason, whatever succession reason, basically being the one that was like, okay, you are going to be sultan.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I wonder if
he was not only considered legitimate, but he was the first choice heir.
And he was the first, the fourth son. And so much was he the first choice heir that, not to get ahead of myself. Anyway, so he was being groomed from when he was very young to be the next sultan. Okay. So much so that his father, when Mehmed is only 12, abdicates and is like, I'm retiring. This is my 12-year-old son. He's going to run things.
When there are older boys that you have. Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Either he really hated his other sons.
Yeah.
Or this one boy, he was like, you're it.
Or maybe it's like something to do with the mom. Maybe she was a favorite or something like that.
Maybe she had blackmail.
Yeah, maybe.
I love the most outlandish theories.
I know. So for whatever reason, the Murad II, the then sultan, was like, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm retiring. This is my son. He's 12. He's going to do this.
Good luck, everyone.
Which means everyone else around them that's like looking at the Ottoman Empire and being like, hey, we got to do something about them, is like, oh, there's a 12-year-old in charge. We're going to do something.
Time.
So during his first reign, because he does essentially, I'll get into that, but he's like basically like, no, I'm not doing this. So
his son decides he's like,
basically what he does. So,
oh my gosh.
Like, there's 2 years that he's in charge. And at that time, the King of Hungary, the Pope, the Byzantine Empire, and Venice, all of them start to be like, okay, we have to take them out now. And they all get together and they organize a crusade against the Ottomans. And so he's like, there's a crusade happening and I'm 12. And so I can't be in charge of this. So he tells his dad, so you're coming back. And basically, like, how the story goes is he's like, well, either you're the sultan and you're in charge, or I'm the sultan and I'm telling you that you have to come and be in charge. Which, honestly, good for him.
Yeah, no.
Like, that shows a lot of, like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm 12. Like, I'm not going to fight a crusade. So Murad II does come back, and he is the one in charge functionally, but he doesn't regain the title of sultan, but he's the one in charge. He's ahead of the military, and after they successfully throw off the crusade in 1444, he's the one who's pulling the strings. And he does that through the end of his life in 1451.
I thought this was a good idea.
I know. So that means in 1451, when Mehmed was 19, a much more suitable age in theory at the time, compared to 12 years old, he officially becomes sultan and would reign for the rest of the time that he reigns. This does mean that's 1451, meaning that he sacks Constantinople when he is 21 years old.
Okay.
21 years old, and he's able to pull this off. That is like so impressive.
Okay, maybe he really was like that smart and his dad saw that, because that's the only acceptable. Yeah. Like, I can't understand how.
I mean, maybe. Yeah, he's just got the brain for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess.
So that's our context. One thing I forgot to mention is that in addition to Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire has like a few land holdings. They have some like British islands and some stuff here and there, but they are not the land that they used to be. And the Ottomans were basically kind of like, they knew it was coming because the Ottomans were gaining land that was basically encircling them and kind of suffocating them.
Oh, so like they, choking them out.
Yeah, so they knew that the attack on Constantinople was going to be coming at one point.
Okay.
It was like a question of when that would come.
Okay.
So, essentially, the interesting thing about Mehmed is that he is reportedly from birth not only groomed to be a sultan, he is told that, like, it is his destiny to sack Constantinople.
Interesting.
And that's why we see him so early in his reign be like, I'm gonna go do this because this is my destiny, and he fulfills it.
I wonder if that was like a religious prediction, like a prophecy almost, or like an oracle.
I maybe so, but he was just kind of told like, this is going to be you.
Okay. Well, whether or not it was going to happen, he made it happen. So,
to me, I'm kind of like, maybe it's just because, like, they had that land and they knew it was going to happen eventually. Mm-hmm. And because his dad, it seemed like he was aging at that point. They were like, well, he can't do it. So it's got to be his son, you know, to carry on that legacy. So at first, Mehmed seemed like an honest, like, hospitable ruler. And this might be some of that, like, religious tolerance that we see within the Ottomans. Because, like, Christian ambassadors from Christian countries were, like, well-received in his court, better than they were with his father. Like, he had good communication and all of this stuff. And he was generally, like, easy to work with. Okay. And to me, this is all kind of like a guise, like a just like, oh, I'm going to be really nice while I'm literally planning to sack your city.
Yeah.
just so you won't pay attention to that.
Yeah.
So during these first 2 years, he's kind of pressing his advantage into the area that Constantinople is. Okay. On the Bosphorus Strait, he actually builds 2 towers on either side of the strait that basically means that he controls Bosphorus Strait. Any boats coming through it has to pay taxes to him. That gives him, like, a huge strategic advantage when you're coming to attacking Constantinople, because he's already got power in that area. You know, all of that stuff. He can control also who is, like, supplying Constantinople, at least from the sea. All of that good stuff. So he's doing all of that in the meantime. He's also doing things like preparing for siege. And he understands that these walls were no joke. I mean, famously, they were no joke. So there's this guy. And he's apparently, I saw in multiple different sources, this guy is kind of like a historic mystery. We don't really know who he is or, like, kind of where he came from. All we know is that he's really good at making
specifically cannons. I think I know what you're about to talk about.
So this guy's name is, I believe it's Urban. He's in here somewhere because I'm just kind of talking now. Yeah, Urban. That's all we know about him. We don't know any other name. We don't know anything. We do know that he offered his services to the Byzantines, so to Constantinople, first. He's like, hey, I can build you a really freaking big cannon. Do you want it? And they're like, we do, but we can't afford you. And so he's like, okay, too bad. So he turns around and he's like, well, I'm going to go to the Ottomans.
Oh.
Hey, I can build you a really freaking big cannon. And Mehmed is like, you know what?
I would love a big freaking cannon.
I'm going to buy that big cannon from you. And not only am I going to buy it, I'm going to pay you 4 times the price you're asking
for. Oh my gosh.
For these plans.
Talk about buying loyalty. He's not about to go offer it again to anyone else.
No. These cannons, it's kind of no question why these were so attracted to Mehmed. These cannons were 27 feet long. They are some of the biggest cannons that we see.
That's like the size of this room.
I know. 27 feet long. They are massive. They were called a basilica. And they were able to hurl a 600-pound ball over a mile.
Over a mile?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a trebuchet without a trebuchet.
This is like a big mamma jamma. Like, this is a big boy.
That is siege warfare. Yeah.
This is how you take, if you're going to take the walls in Constantinople down, this is how you're going to do it.
The trebuchet cannon.
Yes.
Okay.
These cannons, they're still, like, I saw a picture of one in a museum. I'm not sure which museum it was, but that would be so impressive to see. For people who were in meters land, that's 8.2 meters long, and the stone ball would be 270 kilogram, being able to launch that over 1.6 kilometers. That is massive firepower. This is like the likes of, no one's seen this before. And the fact that this random dude just kind of shows up with these plans, he's like, hey, pay me money.
I want to build you this.
Mehmed jumps at this opportunity. Obviously, with something that large, it's pretty easy to see that, like, you know, getting ammo for it is going to be difficult. Just getting them there is going to be difficult. So he has factories built just for the creation of more of these cannons and more
commit to the bit.
Boulders to commit throw to it bit. To launch in the cannon.
That's all I'm gonna say.
Not only does he do that, this is the funniest part to me. In order to get them to Constantinople to take it, they have to go over roads. He has to launch basically a civil engineering campaign to make sure that the roads between where they were being produced and Constantinople could bear the weight of these cannons. He has to improve the roads to get them there.
When all you wanted was a cannon, but suddenly you gotta work on the infrastructure of your city.
I mean, like, he had the foresight to do that, because how many times have been like, because you could easily see him being like, well, and then they had these giant cannons, and but they couldn't get them there because they, like, came to a bridge and it collapsed.
Yeah.
The first one that went over. So he had the foresight to be like, no, we have to, these are some big, big boys, so I've got to get them there.
Gosh.
Yeah. Just incredibly, incredibly insane. One of the, so estimates are kind of different on, like, how many cannons they actually brought to the siege, but historians say anywhere between 12 and 60 of these, like, existed.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and were made specifically for this battle. As much of a positive as they are, they actually had some huge, huge negatives. Because they were so big, it took an insane amount of effort to control them.
And
the
imagine.
Kickback on them would, like, literally kill people.
No.
Yeah, so it was kind of like they had to light it and then run.
Oh, gosh.
Not to mention that each cannon had a cooldown time of 3 hours.
Are you kidding me?
So they had to wait 3 hours for the cannons to cool down enough for them to launch it again. Yeah. So it's not like we can just, you know, and like, bam, bam, bam.
Okay, this is a lot, guys.
So as much as they helped, they probably weren't helped as much as, like, you know, Mehmed probably wanted them to.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, once we actually get to the siege, that 3 hour time span is, like, just enough time for the people in Constantinople to, like, shove stuff in the holes that they made. And apparently the type of materials they used to fill those holes were ended up being more absorbed, like, they absorbed more of the cannon's force, so they actually made the wall stronger. So it's like kind of backfired. Literally backfired. But they still were like packed, like, that's a massive punch, and there's only so long that you can go around and, like, literally like stop up holes.
Well,
you know,
and I won't lie, for someone who's, I'm not a big fan of, like, war history, specifically, like, tactics,
yeah,
some of the most fascinating shit in history was invented because people just wanted to see things go kaboom.
I know,
like,
I know,
really, like, this,
the human urge to see an explosion,
to see the kaboom. Like, freaking
wow.
We still don't know what Greek fire is made out of.
Yeah, I know.
We still don't know. We cannot reproduce it. We don't know what it is. We just know that water makes it worse.
Yep. Yeah,
it's literally,
I know.
I know there's discussions right now, like, was it actually, like, napalm? Like, what right. is it? What's the equivalent? But, like,
yeah,
so much of the stuff in history that's, like, crazy interesting or has been lost or we don't have anymore, it was just because people wanted to see a big boom.
Yeah. They're like, you know what's cool? Fire. You know what's really cool?
Everyone's just secretly a pyro.
Yeah.
I lay credit to that. I openly. If I ever, yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why Michael Bay got so big.
Sorry, I shouldn't use pyromania either as, like, a joke, because it is a very serious affliction for people who have it, but, like, I should say I am a big fan of lighting things on fire. I really like fire pits.
Hey, controlled is a good thing.
Yes. Yeah, I apologize. I should not make a laughing matter out of pyromania.
I can't believe you're being so insensitive to the people of Constantinople.
Sorry.
I just am also, like, I was doing these notes, and I was like, what did these things sound like?
I kind of want to know.
Like,
It had to bust their eardrums. It had to be the equivalent of, like, a jet plane.
Could
or
you imagine being like, oh, okay, like, you know, someone's going to siege us, but we're living literally
in the
untouchable
city. And then you hear
the
loudest explosion
then you're like,
of your life.
What the fuck was that?
And at that point, you're just like, abandon arms, go to the shelters.
Shit, we might be fucked. yeah. So, And he doesn't actually have to wait until the actual siege to test these cannons for the first time. In November 1452, there's a Venetian ship who tries to get through those barricades that he had put through the Bosphorus Strait. No. And they quite literally blow it out of the water.
Just because they didn't have, like, permission, and they were like, who wants to see what it does? Like,
well, I think it's that, and then I think Mehmed was also really trying to make a show of, like,
make an example.
We are not fucking around. So much so that the captain of the ship actually ended up surviving, but was captured, decapitated, and then impaled on a stake.
Oh, my.
As, like, a warning to be like, hey, don't fuck with us. Like, we're being serious about this. Yeah. There's some debate on the actual size of the Ottoman Empire, of the army itself that went to siege Constantinople. There's a historian at the time that reported that they had about 200,000 men, but most historians now, like modern historians, believe that it was probably about 60,000 to 80,000.
Okay.
It's interesting with this history specifically because you have obviously a huge part of the population that's sympathetic to Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tend to exaggerate the Ottoman force in order to make it seem like more of a, you know, unfair and unbalanced battle and, like, you know, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then you obviously have the whole Ottoman slant of things being like, we were the victors and we fought off 1 million men. So it's, you get a lot of bias in that. And so, excuse the numbers. One way or another. So on April 2nd, 1453, which I was like, that is very topical timing. Like, we are, this is happening now. And I meant to do this, hold on, 2023 minus 1453. This is the 570th anniversary of the sack of Constantinople. So
there we
go. To those who celebrate.
To those who observe.
So they arrived to the walls on April 2nd, 1453.
Okay.
They camp that night and are kind of like hanging out for a while. Mehmed wants to make, you know, a good faith effort to basically be like, hey, you can surrender and we'll just take the city. Also, I do want to have the caveat that cannons are not like a stranger to the Byzantines. They have cannons in place over the walls. And they have smaller cannons, so they can fire quickly. However, they are used sparsely because the recoil of the cannon actually damages the walls.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, we have these, so we can't use them. So that that first barrage of attack that starts with the siege, they're going to mainly, like, try to fight against that with, like, archery and stuff like that. They also have Greek fire, which is, like, you know, Greek fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, have fun.
It's hard to, you know.
Nope.
They're surprisingly feeling pretty good. They're like, you know what? We're in the unsackable city. We've got our cannons, if we can use them if we need them. We've got archery. We've just patched our walls up because we knew this was going to happen. We should be fine. They knew and they understood that, and they had already reached out to Europe for aid. But as I mentioned, Europe was, like, not really going to, they're like, okay, we don't care. They knew that they couldn't last through, like, a whole siege, but they were pretty confident that they could last long enough to have aid from Europe come and help them.
Okay.
So they're like, we don't have to make it through the whole thing. We just have to make it long until enough. Our, like, buddies come and help us.
Yeah.
So this is why when on April 5th, Mehmed sends basically being like, hey, surrender. And he even, like, extends the offer that would allow Constantine the 11th, the emperor at the time, to, like, maintain some of the land holdings of the Byzantine Empire. So the Byzantine Empire, even though it wouldn't be, like, an empire, it would still exist in name, and it wouldn't be, like, a complete fall of the whole thing.
Right.
And they're like, no.
There's honor a little. Oh, they said no.
They're like, no. Y'all can come on. We're not gonna do that. There's conflicting accounts that I saw. Either they were like, no, we think we got this, so you guys bring it on. Or they just didn't respond. So they're like, okay, I guess we're going to do this. So this is where I kind of want to pause. And I've talked a little bit about the Byzantine defense up to this, but I want to take some time to, like, really talk about it. As I mentioned, they knew that they would not be able to survive like a whole siege that's lasting like weeks and weeks and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But they were like, we just have to hold out long enough to get our friends from Europe to come send us aid. However, they vastly overestimated the interest that Europe had in the Byzantine Empire.
Oh, no.
Again, the Great Schism had basically meant that, like, no one cares about you anymore. Not to mention, Europe's dealing with, like, a whole bunch of stuff at this point in time.
Yeah.
This is the 1450s. We, again, have just gotten over the Black Plague. France and England are just recovering from the Hundred Years' War.
They're duking it out.
We have some huge political unrest, and quite literally the Reformation happens like 50 years after this.
And so there's already some people who aren't super happy with things.
And like Spain's got a whole thing going on. Like, Europe is not at the point where they are like, I'm going to offer aid to this country I don't even care about.
Yeah. They're being selective.
Yeah. All of that being said, Venice did send 2 ships and 800 men in April of 1453, and they arrive before the siege begins. So they do have some 800 men to help.
Credit
them
for trying, I guess. Thanks, Venice.
Genoa says, like, okay, we'll send you another ship. And then even the Pope is like, okay, I guess we'll help you, and promises to send 5 armed ships. But by the time they got over there, the Ottomans had already blockaded the city. So not super great timing, and doesn't end up helping much, at least in that initial siege. One thing that is very beneficial to the Byzantines is on one of the Venetian ships, there was a man who came to the Byzantines who, I don't know what he did that this was his title, but his name was Giovanni Giustiniani. Giustiniani, I think that's how you pronounce it. He was a siege expert. Which I'm like,
what have you done in your life to earn that?
What makes a person a siege expert? I want to know.
I feel like you have to be involved in at least 4 sieges before that point.
Yeah, this man's got some experience, obviously. And he actually is able to do a lot to help the Byzantines throughout the preparation for the siege and then in the actual siege itself. His title was well earned because he knew what he was talking about. So as far as like preparations on the Byzantine side go, there was not much that they could do. Their army was less than 5,000 men. And those men not only had to like fight, but they also had to man the wall, which meant that the wall, they had to basically take like strategic priority on where they placed their men on the walls. Of course, they focus on the landed side because that's where they were attacking from. But there's two whole sea walls that are not being, you know, as well staffed, essentially. They did what they could to stock up on food and arms and prepare for it. But there, again, there's only so much they could do. What's even more kind of, oh man, for the Byzantines is, you know, there was a Byzantine Empire, a sea-based empire. So at one time had a very large navy. At the time of the attack, they had 26 ships.
Oh my gosh.
And most of them did not belong to the state itself. They belonged to like private citizens who were just, being like, yeah, you can use my ship. So they were, suffice to say, very much outnumbered. So
at that point you don't even
apparently they were like, no, it's gonna be okay. Constantinople is this, like, as you mentioned, it has this like huge importance, and
it's a lot of
that it really is, and a lot of that is like divine importance. And with other sieges that, you know, attempted against Constantinople, it did kind of seem, like, throughout the 1,000 years that it existed, it kind of seemed that there was some sort of divine interference, especially
to... It just couldn't happen.
Yeah. There was something larger preventing it from happening. So they were kind of, like, being like, okay, we're protected. Like, we've got this.
They did not, in fact, got this.
Yeah. Apparently, on the flip side of that coin, talking about like divine messages and stuff, there was a prophecy that proclaimed that the fall of Constantinople would happen and occur when the emperor was called Constantine. Of course, there were a lot of Constantines. And yeah. with that prophecy, I don't really know why they kept calling their emperors Constantine.
I know.
Because this guy was quite literally Constantine the 11th. But so we had a Constantine on the throne. It could happen. And then more ominously, there was apparently a lunar eclipse days before the siege. So obviously eclipses in most of history and in most cultures, not a good sign. Because people are like, what the hell is happening?
What's going on?
So all of that, April 6th, when the Byzantines are like, no, we're going to stand our ground, the siege officially begins. This onslaught would go on until the end of May, May 29th, the same year. So over 6 weeks that they were being attacked.
Jeez.
Relentlessly. They had, of course, those huge cannons. They could do nothing to, and they're not going to take a cannon out like that. Like, there's nothing you could do. Nope. So they did what they could. They repaired what they could. And apparently the guy from Italy, Giovanni, was like a really big, he kind of was like this really charismatic figure. And apparently he kept their morale really high. And he was like one of the main leaders in like being like, no, let's rebuild these walls. We can do this. We can do this. We can do this. We just have to hold out. So all of this stuff, they're fighting, blah, blah, blah. For the first couple weeks, or couple days, I should say, 2 weeks, nothing really happened. It was just kind of like, you know, a siege is happening.
Yeah.
The Ottomans.
Standard
siege yeah. stuff. You know how it goes.
Yeah.
The Ottomans have resource stuff blocked. They're attacking the walls. They're repairing the walls. Yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. On April 20th, those Genoese ships that were promised by the Pope, three of them, that contained not only army men, but also, like, food supplies, they actually managed to break through the Ottoman naval blockade on either side of the Bosphorus Strait.
Oh.
I guess on the Aegean Sea side is where they would be coming from, and actually able to reach the Byzantines. They were able to, like, get there. This pisses Mehmed off. He's like, you know what? Fine. We're going to launch our naval campaign now. You're like, you forced my hand.
I wasn't going to do this, but...
The reason why they hadn't done this yet is because the Golden Horn, which is that, like, very strategic piece of sea land that borders a third of the city,
mm-hmm.
in preparation for the siege, the Byzantines had basically... You know those, like, gate chains that are, like, just one single link of chain with, like, a sign that says, like, no entry on it?
Yes.
They basically did that, but across the entire Golden Horn onto the other side of the land. They put a giant chain, which, like, if you're in a boat, it's gonna stop you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they just, like, roped it off and were like, no, no, you can't come in here. And it worked. It worked. They couldn't do it. They couldn't get past it.
I swear I've seen a movie or something where they did that, where they basically just put one, like, giant chain so ships couldn't cross it, but, like... It's still so funny.
It's such a funny visual.
It's like a whole massive warship stopped by, like...
stopped by a little chain.
A chain!
I know. And it's just... It's so good. So, Mehmed is not deterred. And he comes up with just one of the most brilliant plans and brilliant IUs.
Does he break the chain?
No.
Does he blow something up?
He's like, we're gonna go around... So, I'm not kidding, Kat. He has his men build ramps. And then, with, like, oxen, they haul the ships up onto land. And they just go around the chain. They put the ships on land.
No, they don't. Tell me.
And it
tell
works.
Me you're lying.
And it works. That's the kicker. It works. And the ships are able to successfully relaunch in the Golden Horn.
Have you seen... You've seen Glass Onion, right?
Yeah.
She's like, it's so smart, it's dumb. And he's like, no! It's just dumb! But this is so smart, it's so dumb, it's smart.
It worked. It that's works. The thing. If it hadn't worked,
it
would have been dumb.
But that's not dumb, it worked.
And this and like the whole like, oh, we need to like improve our roads and everything for like this dude had so many ideas that could have gone south so easily.
This is what like you can see that sometimes thinking outside the box really pays off.
Yeah. And this is definitely a think outside the box moment. So good on you, Fromed. Like you did that and you were bold enough to try it too, which is really the thing too.
Commit to the bit.
Yeah. So once they're in the Golden Horn, they basically position themselves and started attacking those sea walls, which means now they're, instead of fighting a one front war, they're fighting two fronts, and with a force that is as small as the Byzantines have, like this really is creates a problem from them. So at this point it was kind of just a matter of when they were gonna fall. But there is one final reprieve that comes from kind of a more unexpected way when, because Mehmed's so distracted and he's a new emperor, there are revolts happening in other parts of the Ottoman Empire. And so people are trying to take advantage of the fact that, hey, he's over here doing this. He's a new guy. Like, if we want to overthrow, we're going to do it now. So he, Mehmed, reaches out one more time to Constantine and was like, hey, we can end this now. Constantine refuses. He's like, no, we're not going to end this. Like, you are going to have to force this city from our hands. So this is kind of the turning point when Mehmed's like, okay, we're going to end this. This is going to be over now.
Yeah.
So on May 29th. You either do
it gracefully or we're going to take it.
Yeah. On May 29th, they launch basically like a go for broke. We are doing this now. Yeah. The city is going to be taken now campaign, where they are just bam, bam, bam. Like they're not playing the long game anymore. He's like, I've got to go deal with stuff in the rest of my empire. We are ending this. I'm done here. So they sent in like their usual cannon barrage, and then they sent in like their troops, and then they sent a second wave in with better armed troops and more cannons, and then finally a third wave of attack on the wall. This kind composed of the Janissaries, which are the most well trained and highly like elite faction.
They're like famous for it.
Yes, of the Ottoman military. Yep. And so that's kind of like what does them in. At this point, the Byzantines had lost enough of their forces and were spread so thin that women and children were forced to also kind of take up arms and to defend the wall, which of course children should not be involved, and regardless, women were not trained in military matters. Yeah. So that creates a huge thing.
I would have supported the women if they'd been trained and you know, allowed to prepare for this situation.
Right. Yeah, kind of put in a bad spot. And then, apparently, allegedly, some dummy does it again. And there was a small gate in one of a section of the walls that was left open. And the Janissaries, of course, did not hesitate to use it. This is why I say, I don't know if the walls ever really fell.
Yeah, this sounds like...
Because it sounds like they just found a way in.
Yeah.
And didn't actually finish getting through the walls. At this point, May 29th, this day is like chaotic as hell. And the only thing holding the Byzantine remotely together is some semblance of order. But when the Janissaries make it in to the city, they are able to climb the wall and raise an Ottoman flag on one of the walls. This creates mass chaos in the city because you see that flag and you're like, oh my god, like, oh, we're it done. Happened. It, like, and there's no way to communicate, like, no, we're not. It's just one guy.
Yeah. Like, that's a really interesting tactic. Like, tactically, to like raise the flag before you've won to just make people think, like,
oh, we're like, done. Because at that point, that's such a strong symbol of, like,
We've lost. We're done. Either we've lost it or we conceded.
Mm-hmm. And of course, like, you know, when that's your only mode of communication, that's it's really hard. So now that, you know, it's kind of chaos, the Ottomans are able to press their advantage and, like, basically flood their city. The Janissaries are also able to, like, get to the main gate and allow their side in. And so now people are in the city actively attacking. And most of the time, most of the defenders at this time are now taking the chance to be like, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to go protect my family.
Yeah, yeah.
So they abandon their post. Valid.
Yeah.
And it's somewhere in this chaos that we believe that Constantine was killed in action. We think that most likely he had shred any form of, like, emperor, anything.
Makes you a bigger target.
Exactly. Too,
yeah.
A bigger target, and he didn't want his body to be used as, like, a trophy.
Right.
So he didn't want anything identifying him as the emperor. And so likely he was fighting alongside his people and died at some point in the battle. There is this kind of, like, legend that he fled the city, but
there will always be legends, especially when it comes to,
like, all of these legends. There's even a more outlandish one which said that he had not died at all, but instead was magically encased in marble and buried beneath the city, and one day he will return to rule again.
Like JFK Jr.
Like JFK
Or sorry, no, Bobby Jr. Kennedy. That's the one that's...
Yeah, whatever one they like.
JFK Jr. is the one that actually did announce his...
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I can't keep track.
No, I don't know. The Kennedys, they all name them all the same thing,
one of the Kennedys
too.
Actually announced their bid for presidency.
Whatever one's actually alive.
Yeah.
And I like when we were looking at the article and I was like, wait, did it happen? Did he come back to life?
I was like, oh, technology has progressed.
Wow.
Yeah. No, whenever you don't find a body... It's going to host magical mysteries
and legends and all of this stuff. So this is really what we consider this whole chaos and taking over is the fall of Constantinople. After May 29th, Constantinople has fallen. The city, the impenetrable city, was penetrated and is gone as we know it. To add insult to injury... Mehmed gives his men 3 days to do whatever they want to the city. Whatever they want to whoever they want in the city. 3 days of pure chaos. Just absolute insanity. And this is anything from...
Oh, God.
Obviously what we're all thinking, and I'm not going to mention it, to just, you know, looting places for the riches that were there, to capturing people and making them slaves and all of that stuff. At the end of this 3 days, estimates are that about 4,000 people were just killed outright, and over 50,000 people were shipped off as slaves. Unfortunately, a lot of people sought refuge in churches and barricaded themselves in, including this also happened in the Hagia Sophia, which that building is fascinating and has such a rich history. But obviously what's kept in a lot of churches, especially ones that are Eastern Orthodox, a lot of very pretty golden things. So they were huge targets for their treasures, and which meant that the people inside were victims.
Right.
We will never.
Yeah, soldiers who just went through a siege are not about to respect the rules of sanctuary.
No, especially when it's not their religion.
Yeah.
Even, you know, as accommodating as the Ottomans were to other religions,
they didn't care about that at that
point.
They
did not care.
They weren't there for religion.
No. So we will really never know the true number of, like, art and artifacts that were lost. I mean, books were burned. Anything that had, like, a Christian message or anything was, like, destroyed into whatever way they could. This includes frescoes and mosaics that were, like, parts of buildings, all of this stuff. After those 3 days, Mehmed himself rode through the streets and, like, made a whole procession of it. And he rides to the Hagia Sophia, which at the time was a Christian church, which is the largest church at the time in all of Christendom, and establishes that it's converted into a mosque, which this cracks me up because the mosque's name is Hagia Sophia.
Yeah.
So he was like, I'll keep the name, but I'll add a little flavor to it.
Yeah. put my own spin on it.
Yeah. So he then stopped to pray, and then he demanded that all further looting cease immediately.
Wow, you saw the light, did you, you asshole?
Sorry. Yeah.
That was...
And so with that, after that three-day period, his conquest of Constantinople is now complete. He establishes Constantinople, I don't know if it's immediately after, but pretty quickly after, it becomes the new capital of the Ottoman Empire. And when he assumes this throne, he also gives himself the title of essentially, like, he's the new Roman Empire.
Hmm.
Which, I mean, like, you know, talking about, like, military and that huge legacy, and I do see, like, why he would be like, yes, I am the new Roman Empire, because that was the last vestige of Rome. He also does something that is surprising. He declares that any Byzantine that had somehow survived the 3 days of that mass chaos would be essentially allowed to continue living their lives unimpeded. And this includes the practice of their religion.
I'm just going to say, how unimpeded can you be psychologically to stay in a city where you watched every one of your neighbors members? Different time, I know, but... Well, not, like, I'm never excusing what you did, but, like, the whole mentality of, like, going through war is so different. Like, civilians and, like, the expectations you have, like, living in the time of, like, what you will see in your lifetime as far as violence and everything. Like, that's, like, something I can't quite comprehend.
I know. It's so different.
And it's not even, I mean.
We have such security in our boundaries, and that's not to say that they don't change.
Well, especially Americans.
They definitely do, but especially Americans. To the fact that, like, back in the day, at literally any point, someone from another country could just decide that, hey, they want our land now.
Yeah.
And you just, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
You know?
I hope that they're smaller than you are.
Yeah.
And that's all. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
such a different mindset.
It would be just so, like...
But also the whole, like...
Damaging to, like, you're just, I could die at any moment because some dude wants my land. Like, yeah.
It's, like, lawless. It really is.
Yeah. So, by 1461, the Ottoman Empire had conquered the last remaining pieces of the Byzantine Empire. And so, the Byzantine Empire was completely dissolved within 10 years of this moment. So, that is the fall of Constantinople. And now I want to talk a little bit about the legacy, because when we mentioned at the beginning that this is, like, the event in history.
It really is.
Like, this is up there with the World Wars. Like, this is such a massive, massive moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Half Arsed History podcast, he literally says, and I agree with this, it's hard to understate the importance of this moment.
Yeah.
Not just because of, like, obviously the lasting impact. I mean, Istanbul is still a part of Turkey. The Hagia Sophia is still a mosque.
Yes.
Like, this guy is making changes that last hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. Yeah. It also has, like, massive effects on how Europe interacts with the Middle East, how world trade happens, how relations happens, how all of this stuff happens, because up until that point, the Byzantines had kind of served as, like, a buffer between the Middle East and Europe, and now that's gone. And so now they have, like, direct contact, and so we see that playing out in huge, huge ways. Not only that, what is really fascinating, and this is why I think I appreciated the Half-Assed History so much, because he makes this point, and I didn't see any articles make this point, but it's so true. With the conquering and sacking and fall of Constantinople, that creates a lot of refugees, specifically a lot of scholar and art and those kind of refugees. And where do they go? Italy.
Yeah, because who would survive that and want to stay even if he offered it? Oh my gosh, I've never thought about that.
I know. They go to Italy.
Oh.
And what happens next? The fucking Renaissance. And so this is why this moment is considered the separation point from the medieval era and the Renaissance.
Not just geographically and lines and everything. This is a intellectual move.
Yes. This
is a diaspora.
Is a major point in our history.
What, no, it's not diaspora. What's the word? What's the word for when you have a massive immigration of people of like, of intellectual? There's a word for it.
I don't know.
I can't think of it. But yeah, no, that's huge.
This is the moment.
Oh my gosh.
Where we are beginning to see the modern era form. Like, we are not medieval anymore. It's not ancient. The last piece of ancient has fallen.
It's gone.
Oh. And we are now on the road to the modern era and modernity. That is how.
That's what we.
Absolutely huge this moment is in history. And it's that a cultural shift. It genuinely is one of the biggest that we've seen. And that is why this is such a massive, massive thing.
Amazing. Not amazing, terrible, but like.
I know.
Like,
yeah. But massive. That is. And this dude was 21 years old when he did it.
That's so crazy to me. The age is what's really.
Yeah. And likely. There was no way he would understand, or anyone would understand, what that would mean for the future of everything.
The full implications could not be known.
You could not know what this path was leading down.
You can't predict, hey, in you know, a couple hundred, few hundred years, there's going to be a world war, and we're going to like be involved, and there's going to be like machine guns. And like, no one could know.
Yeah. This dude was just being like, hey, I was told that I was supposed to go take this city, so I'm going to go take this city.
It's my prophecy. And, like, it's my destiny.
Yeah, and he did it. And it changed the course of world history. So that is the fall of Constantinople.
We really have not talked about much of the fall. Like, we haven't even mentioned it that much, but it's so important.
Yeah, yeah. I think we stumbled across a double theme. Because we had a fall of the Byzantines and fall of the Ottomans. So
we double themed it.
We double themed on accident. Good job. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So...
Whew. Nice job.
Sorry for talking for so long.
No, but... I think we both covered some like really important topics.
Yeah,
I think they need time sometimes to do them justice.
Yeah,
and
it's one of those things.
To give it time than
yeah, yeah.
Just be like, oh yeah, this happened.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we both know that this was never going to be like a short form podcast.
No.
And again, this is one of those topics that, depending on how much detail you go into, you could be here for years.
Yes.
Because you can talk about every minute, everything.
Oh yeah. If I had talked about the Balkan Wars in details, we would be here for years.
Yeah, so I'm happy to do it in about an hour.
It's impressive that you did. It's really, you did a great job with that one.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a good topic to research.
That was great.
I was very invested. So, oh, there was a moment when I was listening to that podcast, and when he said the thing about the Renaissance, I got chills, and I was like, I think I literally was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I love history.
I know. I love that there are like so many revelations you still get.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything affects everything.
It does.
And it's just so like,
everything is one massive pile of dominoes.
Yeah. So.
And nothing we do happens in a vacuum.
No. Yeah. So. Whew. I hope everyone else enjoyed that.
That was solid. No, you did a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Just when you think about trebuchet-sized cannons.
Just giant.
And you know what else I'm going to be doing? Listening to that damn song all night.
Oh, well. That's a given. If I hear, like, cannon blast from your room, I'll know what's happening.
It's the 1812 Overture, actually.
You're, like, on YouTube just watching cannon videos.
Don't tempt me. Don't threaten me with a good time.
Man. So, okay.
Great job.
Whew.
Fantastic.
You too. Great job.
We collected some big topics today.
We did it. Oh, we knew we were going to do it when we picked this theme.
Yeah.
So
Ottoman Empire, it doesn't go small.
No, literally.
It doesn't.
So.
And hopefully next week we will have some other stuff. Well, I know what I'll be bringing you next week. Cal will have something funner to bring you next week.
Yep.
If you are not here for sad, depressing things, skip mine. I'll just tell you that now. Cal, do you know what you want to do? Do you have an idea?
There's some ideas bouncing around.
Okay.
So I'll pick from the bunch.
From the fun, happy jar.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool. Well, if there is some fun, happy you want to hear about, or, I mean, now that my plan for the gunpowder plot and everything, it's all askew, like, let us know what you want to hear. You can tweet at us at TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. We will try to, well, check those regularly. Sometimes we fail at that, but you know, it's also, I'm so bad at the Twitter. So bad at Twitter.
Listen, I'm actively this bad is a hobby. Media. All right. Yeah. It's a miracle that we record every week.
It really is. So yeah. And if you want to keep having us record every week, we appreciate the support, and you can support us by reviewing, and letting us know how we did on Apple Podcasts or any of our platforms.
Yep. That is like the number one way to support us. And every review you leave is, I got one this week.
Oh.
Every time, another listen of that song for Kat.
Oh, another listen of Constantinople by We Might Be Giants. Yes.
Listen to that song. So.
Oh, I will do it too. However many listens we get, I promise I will listen to that song that many times, at least, minimum.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay. Well,
in the meantime, thank you all so much for listening.
Yep. And we hope you learned something. And this is a reminder.
Oh, yeah. No, this has not been
a history
lecture.
Bye.